Hello everyone, it's March 19th, 2024. So Ben's away on business and Dennis is still a little ill. So no regular show this week, but we do have an interview with Professor Dante Loretta, PI of the OSIRIS-REx mission, and he's got a new book out called The Asteroid Hunter. So here's the interview. Hope you enjoy it, and liftoff.
Today we have, I'm so excited, Professor Dante Loretta. Welcome, Dante. How's it going?
It's going very well. Thank you. It's exciting to be here.
We are so happy that we are finally able to make this work out. So Dante Loretta is best known for being the PI for the OSIRIS-REx mission. And he also has a book that's going to be coming out the day this episode is published called The Asteroid Hunter, A Scientist's Journey to the Dawn of Our Solar System. Could you tell us about your book? What made you want to write it? And what story do you tell?
Yeah, thank you. The Asteroid Hunter is really my journey. And I went from this kid who grew up in the middle of the Arizona desert, really with very little access to information or understanding about higher education. And through school and mentorship, I found myself in charge of this NASA mission about 12 years ago. And it was an amazing expedition. We went off into deep space with a robotic spacecraft and surveyed the most potentially hazardous asteroid in the solar system. There was tons of challenges and teamwork. And I really hope it reads like an action adventure novel. How did we do this? How did we pull off this amazing engineering and scientific feat?
You know, unfortunately, I've been so busy. I've not had a chance to read any of the book. But I read one of the first couple of paragraphs in the book, and it seriously sounds like Carl Sagan. Were you intending to do if you want to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe sort of reference in your like introduction, the twin carbon atoms section?
Right. Yeah, the two carbon atoms is a story that underlies the grand adventure of OSIRIS-REx. And you're absolutely right. It is channeling Carl Sagan, who famously said, "We are all made of stardust." Mm-hmm. And I really feel that sometimes, especially in my business. I'm trained as a cosmochemist. I study ancient samples from the early solar system to try to understand how the Earth came to be, how life originated on this planet, and how likely is that to have occurred elsewhere in our solar system and nearby exoplanets and really as a universal phenomenon. So the two carbon atoms are separated when they arrive at our solar system. One of them ends up in me. One of them is in asteroid Bennu, and they're entangled. They were born together during stellar nucleosynthesis, which is the process inside stars where new elements are formed. And it's kind of that feeling that I had, like I was being drawn into this adventure, like the universe was helping me, because it's such an amazing thing that we did and that I got to be part of and be the leader of. There's this cosmic underlying imperative that I tried to capture with the story of the twin carbon atoms.
One of the questions that we get, I love that you have spent so much time talking about your history, because one of the questions that we have often gotten on this show that I feel completely unprepared to give a good answer for is when high school kids getting ready to go into college write in and ask, "I want to go work in space. What should I go study?" And obviously there are a bunch of different answers and a bunch of different paths you can take. But I was wondering if you had any advice for people who don't know how to get where they want to go and maybe don't even know exactly where they want to go. They just know that they want to work in space.
Absolutely. I was that kid in 1988. I arrived at the University of Arizona campus in Tucson without really a clue about what I wanted to do or where I wanted to go in life. And so the first thing I did was kind of play to my strengths. I always tell my students, find the thing you love to do and make that your job. That is the secret to a happy life. And I really enjoyed math and science. That's what I was good at in school. So I chose math as a place to start, partly because I was completely naive about what it meant to pick a major, but also because it's so fundamental to understanding and, most importantly, describing how the universe operates. So I would say if you're inclined in that area, you can't go wrong with math or physics. However, what's really driving the field these days in planetary exploration is astrobiology and thinking about life, life as a universal phenomena? How did it originate? How did it evolve on Earth to the point where we could now ask that question and build amazing machines to help answer it? And where else is it going on? I think there's several locations in the solar system where there's a good chance of biology. So understanding life as a fundamental phenomena, which is molecular and cellular biology or biochemistry, is also a really good place to focus. But I would say science is also about dreamers, especially space science, right? We're kind of the humanists of the physical sciences in that we think about these big pictures. So there's room for artistic support, expression. There's room for creative writing and communications. So what I would recommend to students is go to what we call a space-faring university, like my home institution at the University of Arizona, and get involved in something that's happening on campus related to their space exploration.
The humanists of the physical sciences, I've never heard space enthusiasts described that way, but I like it.
Thank you.
So what got you from that first admission and working on math to working on the Stardust program?
When I was a senior in college, in fact, I was going into a fifth year. I had finished the math program and I just decided I didn't want to be a mathematician. I wanted to be doing something more applied, more in exploration. And I applied for a NASA undergraduate research space grant and I got it. And I had been studying it as really just an interest, East Asian studies, focusing on Japan, their culture and language and history. I just fell in love with when I was young, still real big admirer of. And so I got assigned a project on the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And the project was to think about what are we going to do if we find another alien civilization out there that has technology capable of broadcasting across the solar system, across the galaxy. And that was amazing to me. That was like such an eye-opening epiphany that I was, wow, this is a job and you're going to pay me to sit around and think about and come up with, you know, ideas on how we might approach this. This is amazing. This is what I want to do. And I was quickly dissuaded from pursuing SETI as a career because it is fringe. It was, especially back then, it was under political attack as well as just the mainstream science community didn't take it seriously. And so I was advised not to do that if I wanted to have a career in science. And instead, I chose ultimately planet formation. And as kind of a backdoor into still keeping my hooks into SETI, because I thought, well, there's got to be a planet for these civilizations to be on. So maybe I'll understand how the planets form. And back then in the early 90s, we didn't have any detected extrasolar planets. It was still all theoretical. Yeah. Were there other planets around stars nearby in the galaxy? So it was a hot topic to study. And that led me to meteorites, which are fragments of asteroids, mostly sometimes chunks of the moon and Mars land as well. And those are the rocks that remember the earliest stages of solar system formation. And so I did a lot of work. The first 10 years of my career here at Arizona was in the laboratory studying meteorites as a cosmochemist. And we ran into the limitations and of the contamination and the bias of the atmosphere. And that's when the idea of sample return really started to come forward. And Stardust was a comet sample return mission. I was fortunate as an early career scientist to get some of those particles in the laboratory. And one of my students wrote her PhD thesis on that work.
Could you talk more about what it was like working with Stardust material? I mean, until OSIRIS-REx, Stardust was sort of the standout, at least in my mind. Like when I thought about exciting planetary science kind of missions, yes, you know, the rovers are really cool, but like Stardust like went to a comet and brought stuff back. Like how, you know, it's just, I'm a fan.
Yeah.
So I was hoping I could hear more about what it was like to work with those samples.
Absolutely. So Stardust was a mission to return dust from the coma of comet Vilt 2, which is a Jupiter family comet, dynamically young, which is one of the reasons it was targeted. And by that, I mean, when it's a Jupiter family comet, it's typically coming from the Kuiper Belt. And its closest approach is about the orbit of Jupiter. But when it hits Jupiter, not hits it, but comes close to Jupiter, it orbit changes and it goes into the inner solar system and it only gets as far out as Jupiter does. And that had happened within decades for the target. So we were thinking it was a really fresh object from the outer solar system. And then the coma forms because the comet is mostly icy material, water, carbon dioxide, some like things like methane and ammonia, maybe. And those sublimate. They go from a solid to a vapor, and they carry dust grains with them. And Stardust flew through that dusty coma and stuck out what looked like a tennis racket, except the squares were filled with this super low density substance called aerogel, which is silicon based. It's like 99.99% empty, but it has enough material that, because it was a high velocity encounter, the aerogel slowed the particles down. And ultimately, at the end of these long trails, there'd be some solid material left. Now, that made it really challenging to work with, because you were dealing with particles that hit, I think, on the order of 6 kilometers per second, that aerogel, and a lot of the material was altered by that interaction. But there were plenty of pristine comet dust particles in there, and it was really surprising. The mission was called Stardust because we expected it to be filled with material from the interstellar medium, those giant molecular clouds where stars are formed. We thought the comet captured that, and it didn't get processed in the solar protoplanetary disk. But it turned out it was heavily processed material. It looked a lot like the stuff that we see in our meteorites. There were high temperature inclusions, which we think formed close to the sun. And the one I was most interested in, my expertise is in sulfur and sulfide minerals. And there were some really interesting sulfides that looked like they had to form from liquid water. And that was what we ended up publishing on from that collection. So it was a challenging collection, but really foundational in improving our understanding of the material that make up comets, and a lot of fun to be able to be some of the first people on Earth to look at that material.
Do you have a theory as to how part of the comet would have melted to form those sulfides? Because that's kind of been a question that I've had, is like, how would that even happen without melting the whole thing?
That is part of the puzzle. And we talk about that in the papers that we published. And the lead author is Eve Berger, for people who are interested in following up. And it could have been something that happened earlier. There was a larger body that formed maybe in the inner solar system. It got large, kind of like the Bennu, the object of the OSIRIS-REx mission. Looks like it had a lot of liquid water. And that got disrupted, and grains got released back into the protoplanetary disk and migrated out to the comet formation region. That would have to happen pretty quickly. You have to do all that before Jupiter forms, or else you can't jump that gap very easily. The other option is that the comet itself is a fragment from a much larger object, and it, in fact, had some geology that's going on. When you look at Kuiper Belt objects like Pluto or Charon, they're pretty active. So you could have geology and maybe pockets of liquid water if you had high enough pressures, and maybe some radioactive heat. And then the third one is an impact. So you have an icy surface. If you have a high-velocity impact, you could create melt pockets. We see this happening with rocks. You create like liquid magma that injects into fractures. You could do something similar by high velocity impact into an icy crust.
Would an impact leave water around long enough? I mean, I evidently yes.
Well, you know, I don't know that we did the whole kinetic model to validate your statement. So I think it was kind of putting out some scenarios, and we didn't do the detailed simulations. It's a great question, and sounds like a follow-up study would be in order. On that note, one of the missions we've been trying to formulate for the future is a comet surface sample return, which would bring back more material and help us address some of these questions that Stardust raised.
Well, okay. So speaking of surface material, let's move on to OSIRIS-REx. OSIRIS stands for Origins, Spectral Interpretation, Resource Identification, and Security, as in the security of life on Earth. And REx stands for Regolith Explorer. And I had to look that up because I can never remember what the heck OSIRIS-REx stands for, as fantastic as a name as it is.
Well, thank you.
Could you talk about how you wound up at the OSIRIS-REx mission? I understand that you weren't the original PI, right? Like you took over for Michael Julian Drake.
That's correct. Yeah. Well, I started at the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory in 2001, and Dr. Mike Drake was the lab director. And we really bonded. He was 25 years my senior, kind of took me under his wing, became a mentor to me. We would meet regularly for advice. He was also a cosmochemist, so we had a core discipline that we shared. We would be at the same meetings professionally and would hang out there as well. And 3 years into my assistant professor period, I got a phone call from Mike, and he said, He's working with members from Lockheed Martin. Lockheed and Arizona had just partnered with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory to successfully win a bid for a Mars lander called the Phoenix mission. And Lockheed was looking to continue that productive relationship, and they wanted Mike to be the principal investigator on an asteroid sample return mission. I had been working in astrobiology pretty extensively up to that point, particularly focused on the element phosphorus, which is central to all life on Earth in, you know, many different ways. And Mike knew if we were going to sell an asteroid sample return mission to NASA, it had to be astrobiology focused. That is, we had to target an asteroid that was carbon rich and water rich, the kinds of objects that we think delivered those essential components to the surface of the ancient Earth, making it a habitable world and possibly providing the prebiotic molecules that assembled into the first life forms. And that wasn't his area of specialty. He was a deep, high-pressure chemist. He looked at the formation of metallic cores and the kinds of elements that would go into the core versus stay in the mantle. But he knew that's what I was focused on. So he brought me in as the science lead. When you're the principal investigator, you're responsible for everything on the program: the management, the budget, the schedule, the personnel, the politics, the, you know, everything falls under the PI bucket. And what he was offering me was, I wouldn't have to worry about any of that stuff. All I had to do was think about, why do we want to bring an asteroid sample back to Earth and study it in our laboratory? So I had to write that science rationale. And the awesome acronym that is OSIRIS-REx is the outcome of that assignment, because that's how I came up with those words, because they capture the different communities in the scientific realm that are interested in asteroids, right? Origins are people like me. We're in the lab. We're looking at the organic molecules and how could these things have led to a habitable environment on the early Earth. When you're looking at security, you're thinking about planetary defense and how do we characterize asteroids? What are we going to do if there's one that's on an impact trajectory with our planet? Resources gets you to asteroid mining, and people are trying to think about how do you create an industry in outer space. And spectroscopy, or spectral interpretation, is the astronomy community, because that's how we study most asteroids, by looking at the reflected or emitted radiation and trying to figure out what they're made out of. So that was how I got involved. That was 2004. We had to work for 7 years writing five different proposal documents before NASA finally selected the mission in May of 2011. So Mike and I were, you know, thick as thieves at this point. We had just been in the trenches for years and years and years refining this mission concept. And he passed away just 4 months after we won that contract in September of 2011. It broke my heart. It's still hard to talk about. And then all of a sudden I'm in charge. And now I have to worry about the politics and the budgets and, you know, interfacing with Lockheed management and the university administration and all the up and out activities that come with being the PI. Now, it wasn't just fresh, because Mike had been sick for at least a year up to that point. So I had been stepping into the role and back as he came online. But at the end, it was kind of a crash course in project management, system engineering, and maybe you get to do some science on the side and you're lucky.
I mean, it sounds so difficult, but I can't think of a better way to take over for somebody and a better way to remember somebody than to get to continue on in their work. So
yeah, thank you. He's been with me the whole way. I know he is super proud of everything we've accomplished. Mm-hmm. He would love it to be here in Tucson with these samples in the laboratory. So I think about him all the time and just smile, because I know how excited he would be if he was standing there next to me on the electron microscope.
That's awesome. So getting these samples, obviously there's this long trip home, and, you know, recovery and actually getting your hands on the samples. So, you know, metaphorically getting your hands on the samples. We really don't want hands on the samples.
That's but, for sure. No, we have a whole system to make sure that doesn't happen.
Right. But the actual sample gathering effort, was so much fun to watch. We're big Tag Sam fans here. And I mean, the fact that you were able to collect so much more material than you expected with just one try, was such an amazing outcome. And so I was I know that data or like initial findings are going to be published soonish. And so I don't want to step on any of that. So feel free to answer vaguely or turn me down as I ask this question. But one of the interesting things was that when TagSam hit the surface, Regolith went everywhere. And mm-hmm. I believe the expectation was that Bennu had a fairly coherent surface of Regolith. I mean, it certainly looks like it's one blob of material rather than this very loose pile of gravel. And so when TagSam hit the surface and, you know, basically gravel went flying, it showed just how little cohesion there was between those surface particles. In order to try and stay away from what is going to be published soonish, what was your initial reaction to seeing those photos and to understanding just how big of a rock splash there was? In your head, how likely was that outcome to be? And then when it actually happened, how did that alter your understanding of the asteroid?
The information came in stages. So on the day of the actual sample collection, we didn't have images because the spacecraft was barely able to transmit data, getting close to the asteroid's surface in a very specific orientation. We couldn't get the right antenna at Earth for high data rate. So we were just getting what I call breadcrumbs, 40 bits per second, like 40 ones and zeros came down from the spacecraft every second. So we were only getting basic knowledge about where the spacecraft thought it was relative to the surface. And I would say for me, that was really profound because I knew it was 18-minute one-way light time, but I experienced 18 minutes of travel, you know, and I was like, yeah. That's really far away. You know, that's really far. And that enormity of the distance, I actually comprehended it, which I had never really done before, like the scale that we were talking about and that we were operating over. But everything went great. The spacecraft went in. It had a decision to make. It could have waved off and not made contact if it thought it was going to touch somewhere we had painted red, which meant hazard in its onboard memory. But it made contact and everything seemed fine in terms of the spacecraft was in great shape. Power was still flowing. There wasn't a ton of dust on the solar panels. The heat was still being radiated away, so the radiators didn't get contaminated. So that was all great. And I didn't actually get to see the images until about 2 a.m., almost 12 hours later. And I was in a little Airbnb tucked in Littleton, Colorado by Lockheed Martin. And I had to wait, like the images came down 1 minute and the money shot was like number 70. So I had to wait over an hour as the images came down one by one. And most of them are just the asteroid surface. And then I see right before contact. And then the next image is right after contact. And I put those two blinking together and we have the blinking GIF available on our websites. And I could just see that we were sinking in, that there was nothing stopping us. And there was a lot of material being flipped up and some rocks were getting crushed. And I was ecstatic because I was like, we got sample, because that was the best kind of configuration for TagSam to push it down into the subsurface. We had 1 second before we released the gas, right? TagSam is kind of like a leaf blower, just pushes rocks and dust into a filter with a stream of high pressure gas. And it was 10 centimeters deep before that gas was released. So we packed that head full of material. But the surface of the asteroid was so loosely bound that we just kept sinking. And we went down and down and down. We sunk as deep as 50 centimeters into the subsurface. So the next image was after we fired the gas and all heck breaks loose. There's giant rocks flying around. There's a huge wave of debris that's emanating out from our contact point. We can see where the rocket engines are firing and they're sculpting the debris into an X. Because of where they hit, they're each canted, 45 degrees off point from where the contact was made. And it was astonishing. It really not anything I ever expected to have happen, because we had tested TagSam repeatedly in microgravity and in the labs on Earth with different like super low density materials. And it only ever excavated a tiny little divot about the size of the head itself underneath it. So to see this shocking display was really mind-blowing. And I immediately said to the team, we have to go back and take some pictures after all this settles down and see what happened. That wasn't the plan, but it was such an astonishing result. I couldn't leave Bennu with that mystery hanging over my head. So we went back 6 months later in April of 2021 and got shots of the surface. And we could see we blew a crater that was like 8 meters in average diameter. It was enormous and excavated tons and tons of material. So it was a huge surprise scientifically. But, you know, with asteroid Bennu, which I call the trickster, that's par for the course.
So, yeah, you said it was the most hazardous asteroid or the most potentially hazardous asteroid. So exactly why is that? Is it just because there's so little that you knew about it? But obviously you knew enough that, you know, this was the one that you wanted to sample.
Yeah, Bennu is designated as the most potentially hazardous asteroid in the solar system. And I lean into that in the book a little bit in the prologue where I talk about what would happen if Bennu hit the Earth. So you kind of get a sense of the stakes. And that's based on its orbit and its size primarily. So it's a near-Earth asteroid, which means it orbits inside the orbit of Mars. And it's an Apollo-type near-Earth asteroid, which means its orbit crosses that of the Earth. So Bennu does repeated close approaches to the Earth. About every 6 years, it gets reasonably close. Some encounters are closer than others. And when we take all of our uncertainties in its orbit, and which are very low because of the spacecraft encounter, plus the amazing astronomical campaign we did prior to launch, there's still a region of uncertainty where we don't know exactly how, especially a close approach to the Earth in 2135, is going to affect the dynamics of the asteroid. So it becomes statistical at that point. What we do is we create a swarm of virtual asteroids, each one with slightly different orbital parameters that kind of cover the uncertainties. And we integrate all those forward, and we see that 0.05%, or about one in 1,750 cases, hit the Earth. And that's the highest probability of any asteroid that we've studied like this. And that puts it at the top of the potentially hazardous asteroid chart.
Yeah, because I thought you meant it was the most potentially hazardous asteroid for the spacecraft, not for Earth. So now I understand. Okay. That's actually where my mind
went. It's a friend of the spacecraft, ultimately.
and you know, dangerous asteroids are the easiest ones to get a mission to anyway. So like, it's works out really well, right?
Yes, it was absolutely part of our program. And there was a lot and still is a lot of interest in planetary defense. NASA has a Planetary Defense Coordination Office, and NASA authorization and appropriation acts from the United States Congress always include direction to better understand asteroid impact hazards and characterize the population.
Yeah. Dennis gave us a question after reading your book. He wanted to know what was varied among the different TAGSAM experiments during the parabolic flights.
Great question. Yeah. When we had a whole suite of 25 flights on NASA's reduced gravity aircraft, the C-9B, one of the best times of my life because we got to keep flying in microgravity and I really got pretty good at that.
And did you get nauseated at all?
No, I took the heavy duty anti-nausea medicine and it seemed to work for me. So I was fine. And we had a good flight conductor too. So they, you know, made sure the windows were down. A lot of people get motion sickness if they're trying to watch the horizon when you do a parabola, which is not a good idea. We were varying, and some of this is proprietary in terms of the details, but we were varying the nature of the plumbing system. How much pressure? What's the blowdown rate of the gas? The size of the gap where the gas gets released. So kind of nitty gritty details, because we were trying to achieve, you know, microgravity. You actually can't do that even on the airplane because of vibrations. We were able to get to milligravity. So we were still orders of magnitude different than Bennu. So we were trying to understand how you extrapolate from the surface of the Earth to the microgravity aircraft to the surface of Bennu. So we also ran some different accelerations. You can tell them, hey, target a lunar acceleration. Hey, target a Martian acceleration. So we built up this curve of how collection efficiency changed as G decreased. And then we could extrapolate it to the Bennu conditions, not knowing, of course, that the cohesion was going to be so different. But that was the intent of those experiments. And there is a publication that describes all of those tests if people are really interested.
Hang on, I got to write a note to myself because I want to go look that up.
Yeah, Bierhaus is the lead author, Bierhaus, I think 2018.
So the crater that you guys created on Bennu for some reason just really tickles some part of my brain. It was about 8 meters wide and up to 67 centimeters deep, or maybe 67 centimeters on average.
67 was the low point.
Was the low point. Okay, great. Thank you. And so you had a couple of different sample sites that were picked out, all named after birds. And so this one was Nightingale. Total rabbit trail here. I actually saw a nightingale in a park in Philadelphia this winter, and nobody I was with could figure out what the heck this bird singing at the top of its lungs after sun, like hours after sundown, mm-hmm. was.
That's right.
Oh yeah, of course, that was a nightingale. But anyway, so I don't know what like IAU's standards are precisely, but I suspect that this crater does not qualify to be named.
That's right. Even Nightingale wasn't accepted by the IAU, even though we had tied it to a nightingale in mythology, which is, you know, it was renamed the Hokioi crater, which is a mythological bird from New Zealand. And so all the official IAU names of Bennu features are actual named bird-like creatures from mythology or places associated with those birds. Bennu itself is an Egyptian heron, a kind of a terrestrial manifestation of Osiris, which is why we picked it as the winner of the Name Our Asteroid contest.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I use nomenclature rules are sometimes problematic, but always interesting. And so, yeah. So did this site get a name? Even if it wasn't Nightingale?
Yes, it's the Hokioi crater is what we call that 20-meter crater, sure, where we sampled the interior of. We still refer to it as the Nightingale site, which is fine. It's a mission-specific, you know, language. It's not an IAU-approved name, but there's publications out there that talk about Nightingale as the sample site. And officially, at least in my mind, Nightingale is within the Hokioi crater.
Oh, I will totally buy into that logic. Okay, so then you've got samples coming back to Earth. Can you talk about the heritage going from Stardust to OSIRIS-REx? What kind of lessons learned might have been helpful to get these samples back safely?
Yeah, it was great. A lot of the team members had worked the Stardust mission, which had come back in 2006. And all the way back in 2004, when we first started developing the mission concept, we made the decision that we were going to reuse the Stardust capsule design. For one reason, it worked, as opposed to a similar mission called Genesis, which had come in 2004 and had a parachute failure and cratered. And trust me, we reviewed that tape over and over and over again as a worst case scenario, which I'm so glad I don't have to do that anymore. But we decided Stardust was going to be the form, and we were going to, it's kind of a joke in spaceflight, build to print. Like, you're selling this to NASA at this stage, mm-hmm. right? You're writing proposals and you're saying, this is low risk. We know what we're doing. Look, we're going to just rebuild the Stardust capsule. We already have the design. There's no risk. And then you start to build something and it's 2015 and you're like, well, all these parts are obsolete that went into building the capsule. The whole electronics board, I can't build it anymore because I can't get the parts that we used in 2002 or whatever they were building that capsule. And so you go back and you say, well, the heat shield's still good because that's just a materials casting and the back shell's still good, but we're going to have to completely redesign the electronics. We're going to use the latest batteries. So kind of the smarts of the capsule got all upgraded. And that's just a lesson learned going forward. You really can't bid heritage electronics that are 20 years old. That's the community just moves forward and you can't get those old parts, nor would you want to fly them if there's something better that's out there. The parachute was the same factor. We did have that anomaly that's made a lot of news about the parachute deployment sequence. And that is an interesting design issue that still needs to be formalized as a lesson learned going forward. But the true lesson was redundancy and more redundancy. So we did have a failure of signaling to deploy the parachute at the right time. But we had a redundant system where if it hit a certain atmospheric pressure and the deployment hadn't occurred, it would fire it anyways. And that's what saved us. And we also put a lot of strength on that parachute harness. So the main chute could fully decelerate to free fall velocity with the chute deployed. So that was another huge lesson. And that's kind of more broader in spaceflight, but make sure you've got two ways to solve every problem. So-called belt and suspenders.
That's a good redundancy image. What about the operations side? Were there any lessons pulled from Stardust in terms of how you do things?
We looked at a lot of missions for operations because OSIRIS-REx is so many different kinds of flight in one. Stardust was great for launch outbound crews, but it just flew right past the comet. It didn't spend any time there. It was just a flyby. And then it was great for Earth return, targeting, you know, working with the Department of Defense and Utah Test and Training Range. All of that was great lessons from Stardust. But once we got to Bennu, there was nothing like it in NASA's history or really in spaceflight history before. The closest were the Hayabusa 1 and 2 missions from JAXA, but they didn't orbit. And we did. And that was a real challenge to get that spacecraft into orbit around Bennu. In fact, we hold two Guinness World Records for our orbits, the smallest object ever orbited and the smallest radius of orbit ever achieved. And it was an enormous effort. The flight dynamics team are the heroes of OSIRIS-REx. There was several dozen of them, and they designed all the maneuvers, all the trajectories. They got that spacecraft where it needed to be so we could get those amazing images and spectra and LIDAR data. Just a phenomenal task, and ultimately safely to the surface of the asteroid and back. There's a lot of publications that came out of the mission about the flight dynamics activities. And it's just something that anybody who needs to operate around a small object in the future is going to pay attention to what we did.
I love the flight dynamics for this mission. I mean, it just, you absolutely orbited the asteroid, but for most of the mission, the trajectory of the spacecraft looks absolutely nothing like an orbit, in this really delightful kind of scatterbrained kind of way.
Yeah, I call it the hummingbird, because one thing about dealing in microgravity is you can go into orbit and you can leave orbit. You can't do that at Mars, right? You're in orbit around Mars. Unless you got a giant fuel tank, you're not leaving orbit. And most missions don't have that. They don't need to. And so you can, because orbit, you're constrained to what we call the terminator, which is the plane where the dawn and dusk, you know, are. And so you're always looking at these long shadows, really high phase angles, terrible imaging conditions. So if you want nice pictures, you need to get closer to noon, where it's hardly any shadow. Or maybe you like 2 p.m. because some shadow is actually helpful to interpret an image. And so we'd have to leave orbit and get the spacecraft into that exact condition so we could take all the science data. And we would do that about once a week, and especially in our detailed survey phase. We did that for 14 weeks straight, and the team was beat. They really said, look, we could never do this again. They made that clear, right? Like, this is, we cannot survive another 14 weeks of this kind of operational cadence. And fortunately, things slowed down because we had this amazing global data set and we were starting to focus on very specific locations on the asteroid surface.
So you had said earlier that there were sections of the asteroid that the spacecraft was programmed to more or less avoid. Can you talk more about that? Because I'm guessing that that means like large rocks.
Absolutely. Large boulders. Those are the spacecraft killers that we fretted about endlessly through all of 2019. And really late 2018 when we first got the pictures that showed how rugged the surface was. And it turned out the guidance system that we launched with, which was LIDAR based, a laser rangefinder, was going to tell us, you know, how close to the surface we were and how fast we were approaching the surface. But it only gives you one dimension of information. And when we saw how tight of a spot we were going to have to get the spacecraft into, we quickly realized that that solution was not going to work. So we upgraded and wrote software on the fly called Natural Feature Tracking. And this is an astonishing development. It's never been done in planetary exploration before, but the science team excruciatingly crafted landmarks all across the asteroid surface. And what that entails is a full three-dimensional shape model of that patch, and then a complete photometric model, which allows you to predict how that feature is going to look under different illumination conditions. And so the spacecraft had hundreds of these, some of them big on meter scales, but as you got close to the surface inside that Hokioi crater, centimeter scale objects we were building three-dimensional models of and predicting what the pictures would look like. The spacecraft had all of that in its memory, and it knew which ones it was supposed to see if it was on its nominal trajectory. And it, in the beginning of its flight, it used that information to adapt its final two maneuvers or thrusts on its rocket engines to get down towards the surface and then match the rotation of the surface. And in what we called the match point, it was just falling down towards Bennu with no more propulsive maneuvers planned. And it was predicting where inside that crater is it going to touch. And we had painted some big boulders red, like, don't touch this, don't touch this. You're going to fall over, basically, and crash. And so it was calculating the probability. Am I going to hit something that's red or am I going to hit something that's green? And it had the ability to wave it off. It said at 5 meters, like I think we said 65% chance or higher of hitting a boulder. Back away, and we'll just try to sample another day.
Yeah, I mean, I love this kind of like guidance software. Like terrain relative navigation is really cool. So now that OSIRIS-REx has dropped its sample off at Earth and gone screaming back out into the void, didn't mean for that to be poetic, but that's how that came out. Nice. Now it's on to its extended mission, and it's going to go visit what I believe is another super dangerous asteroid, Apophis, right?
That's right. So we have been rebranded as OSIRIS-APEX. We are now the Apophis Explorer. Apophis is quite an infamous asteroid. It was discovered in 2004. And at that time, it shot right to the top of the most potentially hazardous asteroid list with, I think it was like a 2% chance of hitting the Earth in 2029. And this is a big object, 300 meters, yeah. Not as big as Bennu, but close. And so it got a lot of attention. There's been an enormous astronomical campaign. It turns out it's not going to hit the Earth in 2029, but it's going to get real close, like closer than our geostationary satellites are. And it's going to be the biggest, closest approach of an asteroid for 1,000 years. And if you're in Eastern Europe or Africa, you should be able to see it with your eye, which is really rare to be able to see an asteroid in the night sky. So that configuration, what we figured out is we could get the spacecraft to the Earth in April of 2029 and do this massive, what we call gravity assist, where you use Earth's gravity field to change your trajectory to allow us to rendezvous with Apophis just a few weeks after that. And we've got all these great cameras and spectrometers and the LIDAR systems. So we won't be able to collect a sample and return it to Earth like we did for Bennu, but we'll be able to do the full mapping mission, including gravity field, and we'll do something like the tag when we went down to collect the sample, except we don't have the sampler head, but we'll bring the spacecraft down pretty close to the surface and then just open up the engines and just scour away material and see how big of a crater we blow and can we see the subsurface like we did at Bennu. The good news for me is that I have handed the reins of that over to the next generation. You know, we've had a lot of people, early career scientists that have grown up on this program. We've been funded for 12 years by NASA, and some of us have been working on it for 20 years. So a lot of people have cut their teeth on OSIRIS-REx, and the new principal investigator is an assistant professor here at Arizona, Dani Della Giustina. And I've known her since she was 17 years old, and she took my one credit asteroid seminar when she was a freshman here at U of A. And she's risen up to be the new PI of APEX and leading this awesome spacecraft onto its new adventure.
Awesome. We wish her luck. This is such a cool set of reins to be handed over. So Dennis had another question, and I'm not sure I understand the joke that he makes in this, but he asks, what would an OSIRIS tuplex try to accomplish and what instruments and mission profile would achieve that? So his note is that tuplex is a bad joke, and he basically just means a next-gen sample return.
Yeah, we've been working as a community on comet surface sample return, which for me is really the next step in trying to understand early solar system and especially delivery of chemicals we call volatiles, things that are forming ices primarily. And we worked a mission concept that's called CSER to a pretty high state of maturity, and it's targeting the NASA New Frontiers program, which is the same program that funded OSIRIS-REx. The comet takes OSIRIS-REx to the next level because they're farther away. A higher energy cost to get there. You can't do it. We used a very simple chemical propulsion system. You can't get to a comet with that. You need the ion propulsion, which is, for example, the Psyche mission is flying out to the main asteroid belt. Longer cruise. OSIRIS-REx was 7 years from launch to sample delivery. CSER is at least 14 years. Oh. And you're trying to bring back icy stuff. So you got to keep it all cold. which we didn't worry about on OSIRIS-REx. So there's a lot of new engineering challenges, but it's a worthy successor scientifically as well as the engineering aspects of it.
So you said that Apophis is smaller than Bennu. So when you arrive there, are you going to try to orbit that as well, or whoever takes over?
Yes, when Dani and her team arrive, they will absolutely try to go into orbit around Apophis, therefore breaking our world record, the smallest object ever orbited, which is great. It might not be a smaller radius orbit because Apophis is higher density, so I'm not sure how the masses compare. They might be very similar in mass, even though volume is different.
All right. We have two traditional final questions that we ask. Unfortunately, the end of this interview was a little rushed. So normally we would ask, where would you like to be found on the internet? And we have links to Facebook, Threads, and Instagram. It's AZ Astrobiology on all three. Also, we would like to say thank you to Steph over at Grand Central Publishing, who helped put us in touch with Dante. And Steph asked for us to mention their Twitter and Instagram accounts, which is Grand Central Pub for both of those. All right. Well, Dante, thank you so much for spending this time with us. It's been absolutely fantastic. We have one final question to ask you. What's the least significant question within planetary science to which you have not been able to find an answer? Something meaningless.
The least significant question.
Yeah, something absolutely meaningless that you'd like to know, but you don't know.
Something meaning. Well, the meaningless is throwing me for a loop because if I want to know it, I give it meaning.
Sure. Yeah. Accepted.
I guess, you know, the formation of the H5 ordinary chondrites, like the most abundant meteorite landing on Earth, which nobody studies because there's so many of them. It's almost kind of a oxymoron, right? So we always focus on the really rare asteroid stuff, but that where are all the really common meteorites coming from?
Yeah.
To me, that would be something I don't know, and I would like to know. I wouldn't say it's meaningless, but it's down on the priority list.
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic answer. Okay, well, thank you so much for your time. To all our listeners, consider buying The Asteroid Hunter. It is a great book. Have a good one.